And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein's Song of the Week.
Hey, welcome along. What's the connection between this That's Ann Dudley's spiffy theme for the TV series Jeeves and Wooster, written by my old BAFTA pal, Clive Exton, and starring my BBC Loose Ends colleague, Stephen Fry, with Hugh Laurie. So what's the connection between that and this?
He's just my Bill. He's not the type at all. You'd meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and face, his manly grace, is not the kind that you would find in a statue, and I can't explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill. I love him because he's wonderful, because he's just my Bill.
Okay, here's the connection. The stories of Bertie Wooster and his valet Jeeves were P.G. Wodehouse's biggest literary success, and that song, Bill, is P.G. Wodehouse's biggest musical success, his best-selling and most recorded and most performed song, his biggest pop hit as a songwriter. Did you know P.G. Wodehouse wrote songs? Yes, he did, lots of them. In fact, if he'd been run over by a bus in 1920, the obituarists would have mourned the passing not of a great English comic novelist, but of a great Broadway lyricist. That was Helen Forrest singing there with the Artie Shaw Band. Oh, and bonus trivia. In what Bertie Wooster novel is Artie Shaw mentioned? Answer, the mating season. Quote, she asked if I had ever married Artie Shaw, and when I said no, seemed to think I was pulling her leg or must have done it without noticing. I tried to explain that when a girl goes to Hollywood, she doesn't have to marry Artie Shaw. It's optional. But I don't think I convinced her. Unquote. That's one of the rare mentions of a real-life person, Artie Shaw, in a P.G. Wodehouse novel. Wodehouse published The Mating Season in 1949, and I wonder if he even remembered that 10 years earlier Artie Shaw had recorded his great song Bill. Maybe not, because everyone recorded Bill. Five generations of American female vocalists have sung Bill. Judy Garland.
But along came Bill, who's not that type at all. You'd meet him on the street and never notice him.
Margaret Whiting.
His form and face, his manly grace, is not the kind that you would find in a statue.
Ella Fitzgerald.
And I can explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill.
Dinah Shore.
I love him because he's wonderful. Because he's just my Bill.
Peggy Lee.
Along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You'd meet him on the street and
That's a bit of a crawl tempo for my taste from Peggy Lee. Let's snap it up a bit. Dinah Washington.
He hasn't got a thing that I can brag about, and yet to be up on his knee, so comfy and roomy, feels natural to me.
Well, Dinah Washington blows P.G. Wodehouse's rhyme there. It's supposed to be, and yet to be upon his knee. So comfy and roomy seems natural to me. That's a musical comedy rhyme. And by now, Bill was a heartfelt torch song. Nevertheless, let's redeem Dinah Washington. Let's do that couplet correctly. Shirley Bassey.
And yet to be upon his knee, so comfy and roomy, feels natural to me, and I can't explain, it's surely not his brain.
Well, Shirley got the rhyme, but I'm not sure about that excessively English vowel on I can't explain. Still, you can't expect a British singer to have the command of American vernacular English that a hit American songwriter like P.G. Wodehouse has. So let's bring the Greeks in. Nana Mouskouri.
But I can't explain, it's really not his brain that makes me think. Because he's just my peace.
Whoa, that's Nana Mouskouri from an album titled, somewhat menacingly, I always feel, Nana Swings. P.G. Wodehouse had to wait a long time after he wrote Bill to see it become a hit, over a decade, in fact, until December 27th, 1927, at the Ziegfeld Theatre on Broadway. And the very antithesis of that Nana Mouskouri arrangement, just a rehearsal pianist and a down-at-heel, blousy, alcoholic, ruined Shantuzzi who hops atop the piano to sing.
I used to dream that I would discover the perfect lover. Someday I knew I'd recognize him if ever he came round my way. I always used to fancy then he'd be one of the godlike kind of men, with a giant brain and a noble head, like the heroes bold in the books I've read. But along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and face, his manly grace, is not the kind that you would find in a statue.
That's Helen Morgan with her great number from one of the landmark works of the American theatre, Showboat. Showboat, if you've ever seen it, you'll know it's a magnificent score full of terrific songs like
Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, I gotta love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine.
And
we could make believe I love you, only make believe.
And of course,
that old man, River, that old must know something, but don't say nothing.
Like Old Man River, Showboat just keeps rolling along decade after decade. But all those songs are by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II. How did P.G. Wodehouse end up with a piece of the Showboat action? Well, as I said, long before Jeeves, long before Blanding's Castle, P.G. Wodehouse was a man about Broadway. He wrote musicals, and very well, so much so that to the younger generation, such as Oscar Hammerstein, he became the most influential lyric writer of his day.
There's no question that Wodehouse is one of the great lyricists of the century.
That's the late John McGlynn, a marvelous conductor of musicals and a great scholar of the form. We'll hear more from John in a moment. But don't take his word for it. Wodehouse's lyrics were admired not just by Hammerstein, but by Ira Gershwin, Lawrence Hart, Alan J. Lerner, almost every major Broadway lyricist of the two generations that followed. In fact, two-thirds of a century before Andrew Lloyd Webber walloped the Great White Way with Cats, an Englishman was revolutionising the American musical, along with his fellow British subject, the playwright Guy Bolton. To help us revisit Wodehouse's contribution to the American theatre song, here's Lee Davis, who was not only a biographer of P.G. Wodehouse and Guy Bolton, but before that, growing up way out at the end of Long Island, P.G. Wodehouse and Guy Bolton's golf caddy.
On balance, the songs hold up rather better than the golf.
It was very medium, I would say. They spent more time talking than they did getting anywhere as near par. It was distinctly below par.
Now, of course, you're not just here because you're their golf caddy, but also because you're the author of Bolton and Wodehouse and Kern, the men who made musical comedy. Do you just want to justify that statement before we kick off?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Until this time, the musical theater in America was in the thrall of European operetta. There's no doubt about this. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. It was huge. The spectacle was a very great part of operetta. But it was Kern who invented musical comedy, the American musical comedy, and it was came out of necessity. It was a very small theater.
Now, these three guys, Jerome Kern, Showboat is playing on Broadway today. P.G. Wodehouse, still one of the world's best-selling novelists. Guy Bolton, by comparison, a little forgotten. What is Bolton's contribution?
Bolton's contribution was a book. He was a librettist. He was not the most talented of the group, but he still had the sense, the wonderful theatrical sense of knowing when a song should come. As far as he was concerned, no piece of music should exist that didn't either further the plot or deepen the character.
They met at the first night of Very Good Eddie. There is a song in there that I like. It's so twitchy and catchy. You'll be singing it all day. That's this thing, I Gotta Dance. I Gotta Dance When I Hear Music Calling to Me.
Yes. That's a wonderful, catchy tune. And there is some basis in fact that Guy Bolton had a hand in writing that lyric.
I gotta dance, I gotta dance when I hear music calling to me. I just adore, I just adore to glide around the floor. And when I'm all through with one dance and we sit down to have a talk, and all the tune seems to softly whisper, get up and walk. Oh, won't you stop?
Oh, won't you stop?
Oh, won't you stop the captivating, beautiful tune?
Beautiful tune.
For if you don't,
or if you don't,
or if you won't, I don't know what I'll do.
I don't know what I'll do. I run away from each modulation, but I'm such a slave to syncopation that I've got to dance until the orchestra gets through.
Very Good Eddie,
that's
which had Guy Bolton and Jerome Kern, but P.G. Wodehouse wasn't involved in.
That's right, exactly. Very Good Eddie. And it was not Wodehouse, but Wodehouse was there in the audience as the drama critic for Vanity Fair.
And at intermission, when one of the authors looked at the first night crowd and observed that, quote, it looks like a good house, it was apparently misheard as it looks like Wodehouse. And Vanity Fair's drama critic was brought over to be introduced to Jerome Kern. And if you buy that story, you'll have no difficulty swallowing musical comedy plots. Very Good Eddie was very well received, both Guy Bolton's book, the script, and Jerome Kern's music. Only the lyrics by diverse hands, I think I counted 9 of them, only the lyrics disappointed. So P.G. Wodehouse was signed up as the 3rd member of the team, and a new partnership was born, and was soon the toast of Broadway, as the New York Times cooed. This is the trio of musical fame, Bolton and Wodehouse and Kern, better than anyone else you can name, Bolton and Wodehouse and Kern. As Dorothy Parker wrote after seeing O Lady Lady, Bolton and Wodehouse and Kern are my favourite indoor sport. I like the way they go about a musical comedy. I like the way that action slides casually into songs. That may not sound a big deal, but it was in 1915. John McGlynn spent much of his life exhuming and conducting these shows.
And I'll say this about all of these period books. If they were lucky enough to be written by Guy Bolton and P.G. Wodehouse, they're awfully funny, and they're awfully consistent. Now, there are a lot of scripts from this period that are absolute rubbish. When I started all of this business 10 years ago, I started with the Bolton Wodehouse Kern shows, and I kept saying to everybody, well, yes, everyone says they changed the face of musical theater, but they seem to be perfectly normal, everyday books to me. Well, now that I know how horrifying some of these things were 10 years before, I see so much more clearly than I ever did what a quantum leap these men made.
But in the end, we judge musicals on songs. What kind of numbers did Kern and Wodehouse write for the Princess Theatre shows? Well, some of them are the sort of songs that you might expect the creator of Bertie Wooster to write. As you'll know, Wodehouse novels are full of jokes about songs, about Sonny Boy and trees, and so it's no surprise to find him parodying then-popular Tin Pan Alley song forms, like when it's insert season or time of day here, in insert locale here. When it's nighttime in Dixieland, when it's apple blossom time in Normandy, when it's black fly time in New Hampshire. That's one of mine, that one. Here's Wodehouse's take on the genre.
I've always liked the sort of song you hear so much today, called When It's Something or Other Time in some place far away. Oh, tulip time in Holland, a pleasant time must be, while summer's strong for apple blossom time in Normandy. But there's another time and place that makes a hit with me. When it's nesting time in Flatbush, we will take a little flat. We'll put welcome on the mat, where there's room to swing a cat.
Well, as I said, if P.G. Wodehouse were minded to write a song, that's the sort of song you'd expect him to write. But there were other kinds of songs that he and Kern wrote too. And in particular, what I find interesting about them is there's a real depth and profundity in the music, and a sophistication, even when there's something rather naive and direct and charming going on in the lyric.
The Magic Train in particular, people just would weep at it. And I think it's very interesting. I wrote about...
Were they Long Island Railroad commuters? Because it rings a bell if you've ever had to travel on that.
Well, that's true. It certainly does have an extra layer of resonance if you live out in Long Island. It's interesting. The very first time I ever went to Long Island was only a few years ago. I went out to rehearse with Frederica von Stade when she was still living out in... wherever it was she was, out in Oyster Bay. And I was on the train out to where she was, and suddenly all of these stations, Plandome, Little Neck, all, I went, oh my God, I'm on the Magic Train!
There's a train that pulls out in the twilight, quite the best on the list of all trains that exist, for it brings the commuters home.
When the stars up above shed their shy light, happy men come again back to fair Flushing, Maine, Auburndale, Little Neck, Plandome. Every day, if you are that way, when shades of night are falling,
you can hear gentle voice is a calling.
All aboard, please. All aboard, please. All aboard. All aboard.
Dear magic train that brings you home again, how I shall wish it could fly. How I shall worry and want it to hurry and stare at the clock as the minutes grow by. Down at the gate I shall listen and wait. Oh, how excited I'll be.
Some folks grumble that it's slow.
It stops to ponder now and then.
The air inside needs oxygen.
It's not like some trains known to fame.
But it's enchanted just the same.
It bumps as though the wheels were flat.
It rattles too, but what of that?
You live in the Hamptons, yes. Out at the other end of Long Island. Quogg is kind of just around the corner from you, I guess.
Yes, it is. It's very close by. In fact, this was, again, Woodhouse, because Woodhouse wooed and won his wife on the Long Island Railroad, which is still a very antique railroad that goes out on Long Island. It just about holds the island together.
All aboard! All aboard!
Dear magic train, hear it sing that refrain. We're getting near.
There's something about the music. It is so melancholy and beautiful and happy at the same time. And this is Kern's extraordinary genius. And I can't begin to analyze it for you on a technical level, why he finds just that dip of an interval that'll suddenly make your eyes tear up.
Yeah.
That's the difference between technique and genius.
Well, what I like, which I think is peculiar to the Kern and Woodhouse songs, as you said, there's a melancholy quality to them.
Oh, yes.
And yet, on top of it, you have these ostensibly very funny, droll lyrics. And it's that combination.
Absolutely.
It's so unusual.
Well,
it's almost as if other writers, when they write a funny song, it's a funny song. But mm-hmm. Kern's funny songs, there's a whole lot of other things going on there.
Yeah, well, it's what gives them humanity. They're not just review sketch songs. Something like, well, The Magic Train, it's a charm song. There's no question about it. It's a boy and a girl, and the train's bringing you home, and the magnolia, and the fireflies, and all that. And it could be just charm and sweet and be forgotten with 100,000 other sweet, charming songs from that period. There's something about the quality of that music which gives it the longing, the humanity, where suddenly you feel it's being sung by three-dimensional human beings with real, however deeply buried, nonetheless real feelings. And I think it what gives it its ballast. There's all of this silliness and nonsense going on in the script, but then there are these songs which come right from the heart, and it tends to equalize everything, so you can accept the silliness because there's the humanity folded in with it.
Soft, softly as over the water we creep, winds seem to sigh. Dark, dark is the night and the world is asleep. Wakeful am I. Slow though the river may flow, soon I shall be safe in the harbor where some
That's actually a barcarolle and almost an art song, Dread Phrase. So let me put it another way. Jerome Kern composed the great epic of the American musical, Showboat. He wrote a lot of big movie songs that are recorded and performed more today than when they were written. I Won't Dance, Don't Ask Me, A Fine Romance, The Folks Who Live on the Hill. He wrote what can plausibly claim to be the greatest standard song of all time, or if you want to quibble, at any rate, certainly one of the top five, The Way You Look Tonight. And Go Little Boat will never be a hit on the scale of those, but there is something eerie and insinuating and utterly beguiling.
Kern wrote what he chose to. He had a tendency to write instrumentally and not really take singers into consideration. I have found after 10 years of performing 80% of his output, he doesn't put a single breath mark in any of his music. You have to figure out where you can breathe without breaking either the musical line or the sense of the lyric line. It is very, very difficult.
That's a good example of what John McGlynn meant by Kern not leaving anywhere for a singer to breathe. That come, come to us, we love you so, is tricky to do, and far too many singers take a big gulp of air between the come and the to us and ruin the sense of the lyric. But Maria Jett, who we heard there, she doesn't do that, and good for her. The Siren Song is interesting to me because it sounds operatic when sung as in the show or as sung there, even though it's got a very narrow range, only a ninth. And in fact, as operatic as it sounds in the hands of a lyric soprano, it actually has a palpable, and remember that this is the teens, this is before the jazz age, this is before big bands or anything. And as operatic as it sounds in the hands of a lyric soprano, it actually has a palpable, detectable swing. Which is why a generation later, all the swing bands picked up on it. This is Benny Goodman.
Collegiate piece of fluff, this thing comes drifting in.
So it's a marvelously crafted piece of music that we look back on now and say, God, it's so beautiful. Yeah. The melody is so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And the fitting of the lyric to the melody is so precise and wonderful. And it has implications, I mean, in terms of the plot as well.
A few years ago when we were discussing Kern, you said to me rather early, oh, Kern is at least as great a melodist as
Schubert.
As Schubert. And I nodded, and the producer, who's one of these Radio 3 guys...
I remember this, started to retch. We could see him through the window.
...said, how can you just let a statement like that go? It's absolutely... How can you say Jerome Kern's as good as Schubert? So, make the case.
Oh, I can make the case without a problem. If you're talking about the simple song form, the quality of the melodies and the beauties of the harmonies, I don't think Schubert ever wrote anything more beautiful than Kern's most beautiful things. And Schubert wrote some extraordinarily beautiful stuff. But if you sit there and you listen to a song like Heidenröslein, how is that in any way, shape, or form, even stylistically? It doesn't sound like there are 200 years between that and some of the bouncier Jerome Kern tunes. Take a melody, a Schubert melody like, well, The Trout. You know, bum 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 da 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 dum. These are little more than nursery melodies, but we revere them today. So how different is that from, oh, the rain comes a pitter patter, and I'd like to be safe in bed. Skies are weeping while the world is sleeping. My God, my God. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful melodies ever created by mortal man.
Yeah.
That's a classic Kern song. It's not of any particular harmonic interest. It's pure melody, pure translucent melody. If I had to name a favorite Kern and Woodhouse song, I think it might be this one. Years ago, my friend Dilly Keen from Fascinating Aida and I were working on something, and it wasn't going anywhere, and so we'd bunk off, and Dilly would sit at the piano and lapse into this song, which never failed to cheer me up. It's sung by a girl who likes different aspects of different boys for different activities, and just wishes she could find one boy with all their particular charms rolled into one.
At the opera, I like to be with Freddie.
To a musical show, I go with Joe. I like to dance with Ted
and golf with Dick
or Ned.
And at the races and other lively places,
Sam and Eddie are fun. But I'm pining till there comes in my direction one combining every masculine perfection who'll be Eddie.
Joe
and Dick
and Sam and Freddie
and Nettie
and Teddy
rolled in one.
That's from the 1917 show Oh Boy. The following year for Oh Lady Lady, P.G. Woodhouse found himself writing a song that's really the opposite of that one. Instead of a collection of boys who can all do one thing well, this is the story of one boy who can't do anything well.
He can't play golf or tennis or polo or sing a solo or row. He isn't half as handsome as dozens of men that I know. He isn't tall and straight and slim, and he dresses far worse than Ted or Jim. Still, I can't explain why he should be just the one man in the world for me. He's just my Bill, an ordinary guy. He hasn't got a thing that I can brag about.
Everyone liked Bill. But at the same time, everyone was enough of a professional man of the theatre to understand that it didn't quite work in Oh Lady Lady. So 2 days before the first night, February the 1st, 1918, the song was cut. And that was that. So long, Bill. And so long, too, to Bolton, Woodhouse and Kern as an active, ongoing theatrical partnership. The three of them drifted apart and went on to other things, but they occasionally reunited. Let's dip in on Kern and Woodhouse in London.
I can't resist playing a song that's actually from a London show, and this is one that Kern and Woodhouse did with George Grossmith in 1923, and it has a great song in it called Dancing Time.
Oh, yes, it's a lovely song. I love it.
I love that those lines, take me where you hear all the saxophones moaning. Where can those ukuleles be? We don't have those. We don't score our dance bands that way these days. And it just seems to place it perfectly on some starlit roof in at the dawn of the 1920s and the jazz age.
Well, again, that's Woodhouse locking in time.
Dancing time is just when the music is playing, when the stars are shimmying up in the sky. Dancing time is just when your shoulders are swaying, when your feet have simply got to glide. You must lead me lightly, hold me tightly, take me where you hear all the saxophones moaning. Where can those ukuleles be? Dancing time is any old time for me.
That's the star of the original production of The Cabaret Girl in 1922, my old friend Dorothy Dixon. Very old. She was 102 when she died in 1998. I don't even want to think of what that would make her now. Among those who came to see The Cabaret Girl at the Winter Garden in the West End was Lady Elizabeth Bowes-Lyon. She enjoyed it so much that she came back a second time and brought along her fiancé, His Royal Highness the Duke of York. The Duke of York became King George VI, who became the big Hollywood star of The King's Speech and best supporting actor to Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. Got a big movie career posthumously for some reason. King George VI's consort, Queen Elizabeth, became beloved as the Queen Mother. And Her Majesty and Dorothy Dixon became fast friends. And I remember standing in Dorothy's lovely, somewhat over-ripely coloured drawing room in her flat in Eaton Square, and her telling me that on that very spot, on Dorothy's 80th birthday, the Queen Mum had stood there and sung Dancing Time, word perfect, 6 decades after Dorothy introduced it on the London stage. Take me where you hear all those saxophones moaning. Where can those ukuleles be? Every boy in London is telephoning. That's just marvellous, evocative lyric writing. Yet, no disrespect either to Dorothy's rendition or to the Queen Mother's, but I always had a yen to hear that song taken at a slower, dreamier tempo. So.
Dancing time is just when the music is playing. When the stars are shimmying up in the sky. Dancing time is just when your shoulders are swaying. When your feet have simply got to glide, you must lead me lightly. Hold me tightly. Take me where you hear all those saxophones.
Philosopher who was not wrong. There is a time and place for everything, said he. Time for women, time for wine, and time for song. But when you dance, by gosh, it's time for all the three. Dancing time is just when the music is playing. When the stars are shimmying up in the sky. Dancing time is just when your shoulders are swaying. When your have simply got to glide. Let me lead you lightly, hold you tightly, take you where you hear all those saxophones moaning. Where can those ukuleles be? Every girl in London, I'm telephoning. Dancing time is any old time.
Dancing time is just when the music is playing. when the stars are shimmying up in the sky. Dancing time is just when your shoulders are swaying. When your feet have simply got to glide,
you must lead me lightly,
hold me tightly, take me where you hear all those saxophones moaning. Where can those ukuleles be? Every boy in London is telephoning.
Dancing time is any old time.
You don't need a reason or rhyme. Dancing time is any old time for me.
Jerry Petchell and Brian Lane Green. In 1924, Bolton, Woodhouse and Kern reunited for one final show, Sitting Pretty, which was not a hit. It had a beautiful title song that no one got to hear.
Well, I must ask you about the title song, because there's a story.
We can't tell the story on the radio.
The title song has a lyric that runs, I want to sit, just sit and sit and sit with you the whole day through. And
yes.
It's a beautiful song.
Charming.
It gets to the end, I'd give half the city if I was sitting pretty. I think it's just the deftest, neatest lyrical couplet you could have.
It's lovely.
But it was dropped from the show.
For a most bizarre reason. The actor playing Horace is actually quite famous to us today. His name is Dwight Fry, and he will be remembered to all fans of Universal Pictures horror films, both Dracula and Frankenstein. He was Carl, the dwarfish assistant in Frankenstein, and he played Renfield opposite Bela Lugosi in the film of Dracula. This is about 6-7 years after Sitting Pretty played on Broadway. And he was quite a well-known young character actor. He did plays by Pirandello and all of that. But if any of you have seen his films, you might remember that he does sort of have a small speech impediment, which sort of comes out like this a little bit. So when he sang, I'd like to sit, just sit and sit and sit, it came out rather differently. And the minute they heard it, they realized that Dwight Fry could not sing this song. And it was better to cut the song than to recast Dwight Fry. So Sitting Pretty never ended up in the show, which is no reason to cut it today, of course.
Well, I take it when you were casting around for your recording, the first thing you did was to make sure
that Jason Grodd didn't have a...
where the S sound should be. Who's singing it here?
Jason Grodd, who's one of our finest and deftest light comedians in New York, and a charmer.
I want to sit, just sit and sit and sit with you the whole day through.
Just sit.
That's it. Just sit and sit and sit.
With no one forbidding us.
And nobody kidding us. I want to sit and hold your little mitt on chairs that fit just two. For I'd give half the city if I were sitting pretty little lady with you.
Most of these songs now, these Kern and Woodhouse songs that we've heard today, are forgotten, they're rarely performed. But there is one of them that did have an afterlife.
Oh, yes, and you and I have locked horns on this one before.
It came originally, I think, from O Lady Lady, although the tune goes back even further, according to what Woodhouse had to say.
Yes, it's hard to know with any certainty when the melody for Bill was composed. And there are so many myths and so much false information flying around about this song that when I recorded the original version of Bill on the Broadway Showstoppers album, I thought, well, let's finally set the record straight, because everyone says, well, did Hammerstein rewrite it? Didn't Hammerstein rewrite it? And you took me to task in print for saying that he had, when in point of fact, he said that he hadn't. Well, he did rewrite it. In fact, there's a wonderful letter which surfaced a few years after we had that set to about it, where Woodhouse even wrote and explained the whole story. And he said, of course, Oscar went in and wrote two new lines like anybody would do and then reclaimed the copyright. Yeah. I will say this, to Hammerstein's eternal benefit, the minute Woodhouse complained, he immediately signed over all rights to the song and wrote Woodhouse a huge check for back royalties, and Woodhouse said, well, that's just the kind of guy Oscar was.
Well, now, while we're quibbling about this, let's try and agree on something. To me, what makes the song is, I love him because he's Ida.
Don't know.
Because he's just my Bill. Now, whose is that, Woodhouse or Hammerstein?
That's Woodhouse, actually.
Well, there you are.
But the thing is, the difference is, I don't think it's just what it is, it's how it's done and why it's done. And I think it would be very interesting, I don't know whether you have time in this program, I think it would be very interesting indeed to play them back to back. I don't know that anyone's ever bothered to do that. I've recorded Bill both ways. I've recorded the Old Lady Lady version, and Teresa Stratus and I recorded the Showboat version.
Well, we'll hear it. We'll hear the Old Lady Lady version.
All right.
And I know that long before I heard your recording, you kind of sang half the second chorus to me because Ira Gershwin, among others,
loved that line.
Just sing the lines.
The line is Ira Gershwin knew the original version well, and he used to, you know, when they would have parties and they would talk about songwriting, she goes, he's just my Bill. He has no gifts at all. A motor car he cannot steer, and it seems clear whenever he dances his partner takes chances. And Ira Gershwin used to puff on his cigar and say, now that's a lyric.
It is a lyric. Now, condensed.
For people, since people will be hearing this outside of the context of Old Lady Lady, I think it's important to explain who and what she is singing about. Bill is the leading man of Old Lady Lady, and he is a very sweet, very lovely, rather dim-witted young man. It was played originally by Carl Randall in the original production in 1917. And early in the show, it's Molly's wedding day. She's going to marry him at 5 o'clock that afternoon. And her mother, for the life of her, still can't understand why. So Molly sings this song to her mother to try to explain to her why she is marrying, of all people, Bill.
Sing a solo or row. He isn't half as handsome.
it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill. I love him because he's, I don't know, because he's just my Bill.
That's Bill, as heard in O Lady Lady, and on your recording, who's singing there, John?
That's Jeannie Lehman.
Jeannie Lehman. Now, it started a whole genre of things that was spoofed by Gwen Verdon in Chicago many years later, and she sort of summed up the genre with, Lord knows he ain't got the smarts, but look at that hole, I tell you, that hole is a whole lot greater than the sum of his parts. But the apotheosis of the genre must be in Showboat, where Julie, who is by now the girl who we saw departing in Act One in the big miscegenation scene, she now comes back. She's broken down, her career's in ruins, her man has left her, and she...
And that's a very important thing to remember, is that Steve has deserted her.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happened in the transformation of Bill? In the original script, at that point in the show, it simply says in the script, Julie sings a typical song of the period. And, in fact, they wrote something for her called Out There in an Orchard, which you will find buried somewhere on the third CD appendix of the Showboat recording. But they realized something more emotional was needed, and it's very unclear who suggested Bill, whether it was Hammerstein or Kern, said, you know what might work here? Because Bill had been put in any number of things and cut over the years. And it's also important to remember that Bill was actually cut from O Lady Lady because it slowed the show down. So the first thing they realized, of course, is that if Bill was going to go into Showboat, that all these lines about, you know, his partner takes chances and steering the motor car and all that, well, none of that was appropriate. So the lyric would have to be rewritten. And evidently, from what happened, Kern asked Woodhouse if it was okay to use Bill in Showboat. Woodhouse said, sure, fine, because that sort of thing was done all the time. What he didn't know was that they were going to rewrite it. Hammerstein obviously had to change some of the funny lines into more serious ones. And in the process of doing that, as you will have noticed from the previous version, Kern actually recomposed the middle of the refrain. So musically, it was different. And it became a very different piece, and the purpose of it is much different. And as you listen to Teresa Estrada sing it, what you realize is that she starts out, it's a rehearsal scene. She's just singing the song that she's going to perform the next night on her opening night. But as the song proceeds, she gets more and more into her own inner world, and you realize that she's no longer singing a generic song about a guy named Bill. She's singing about Steve, her husband, who has deserted her. And by the last refrain, her entire life is passing before her.
So it starts off as a song done as a song in rehearsal, but it becomes a
cri de coeur,
soliloquy, part of the book. Well,
and was ever a song transformed from a simple generic charm song into a great moment of music drama? More tellingly, it's quite extraordinary.
Fancy then he'd be
Teresa Stratus with the London Sinfonietta, conducted by John McGlynn. With the exception of Bill and maybe Till the Clouds Roll By, P.G. Wodehouse's novels have lasted longer than his songs. But he understood the impermanence of popular song. In fact, he wrote a song about it for Miss 1917. We're at the stage door of a crumbling, decrepit theatre, where a courting couple are recalling the glory days before the dust and cobwebs, when every night there was a new song and all the boys would wait at the door for the girl who sang it to come out to them. "It's a pity," says the boy, "that all those old songs had to die." "Perhaps they aren't dead, Charlie," says the girl. "Perhaps there's a paradise where the good ones go when we forget them." "I think you're right, miss," says the stage doorman. "For sometimes at night on that dark empty stage, I seem to hear the ghosts of the old songs that were born there all about me."
Dear old songs, forgotten too soon. They had their day and then we threw them away. And without a sigh, we would pass them by for some other newer tune. So off to a happier home they flew, where they're always loved and they're always new.
And then the chorus, a very affecting piece of music with consciously chosen lyric cliches.
It's a land of flowers and April showers, with sunshine in between, with roses blowing and rivers flowing, mid rushes growing green, when no one hurries and no one worries, and life runs calm and slow. I wish someday I could find my way to the land where the good songs go.
Both my guests today are no longer with us. Lee Davis, Bolton and Woodhouse's golf caddy, died in 2011 at the age of 81. John McGlynn, Kern's great champion, was only 55 when he died of a heart attack on Valentine's Day 2009. He could have had a very agreeable life conducting great singers in opera houses around the world, but he loved obscure musical comedy arcana, and so he spent much of his short time on Earth going through abandoned piles of mouldering scores in a warehouse in Secaucus, New Jersey. If you're wondering where exactly is the land where the good songs go, for John McGlynn, it was a warehouse in Secaucus, New Jersey. I thank him for the energy he put into rescuing those lost treasures and for all the terse scribbled notes I received from him after this or that newspaper column or radio show, asserting that I'd confused a number cut on the road from Very Good Eddie with a number added in previews to Leave It to Jane or whatever it was. The waspish Ned Sherrin, the maestro of Loose Ends, on which Stephen Fry and I appeared, Ned once passed us bickering in a BBC corridor about some obscure point and rolled his eyes to his producer, "All these buffs hate each other." Which isn't really true. John, like Lee Davis, was a tremendous enthusiast, and their enthusiasm was infectious. And I hope both of them made it to the true land where the good songs go.
On the other side of the moon, ever so far beyond the last little star, there's a land I know where the good songs go, where it's always afternoon. And snug in a haven of peace and rest lie the dear old songs that we love the best. It's a land of flowers and April showers with sunshine in roses blowing and rivers flowing mid rushes growing green where no one hurries and no one worries and life runs calm I could find my way to the land where the good songs go.
Meredith D'Ambrosio with a song by Jerome Kern and P.G. Wodehouse. P.G. Wodehouse, a peerless comic novelist and a great songwriter. And as he drifted away from the theatre to focus on the books, he nevertheless always told people that when he created those plots for Bertie and Jeeves and Lord Emsworth and all the rest, that he constructed them and cast them like musical comedies. See you next time.
Mark Stein's Song of the Week is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises. All rights reserved.